We show you on energy, on ground track. Nav is go. Copy that. We're ready.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Spinning Logic Podcast, where I'm your falsely narcissistic host, Jason Havey. My guest today is a licensed clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at California State University, Los Angeles. She co-hosted her own show on Oxygen and has been featured as a commentator on nearly every major television network. She recently released her second book, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist. Her name is Ramani Dervasula. Dr. Dervasula, thank you for being on the Spinning Logic Podcast.
Thanks, Jason. How are you today?
I'm great. You know, I was kind of in the same boat as you today. I was scrambling all around.
Yeah.
And I actually thought I was going to be a couple minutes late. And when I saw your email, I was like, whew, thank God, we're in the same boat today.
Yeah, it's Los Angeles where, you know, you have to build traffic into the schedule. So there's absolutely no margins for error here. So, yeah.
Yeah,
it's LA.
I've heard the nightmares about the 405.
It's a nightmare. Yes, and that's exactly the freeway I was on.
Oh, really?
Made me late. So yes,
it's super unpredictable. There's a there's an interstate here in Austin, Interstate 35, that for some reason, like at 3 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon, it's still dead stopped. Yeah.
There was that's the 405.
Yeah, they said there was the five worst bottlenecks in the country. Three are in LA. The Holland Tunnel in New York and I-35 in Austin. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, I'm excited to have you on the show. I got all sorts of stuff to talk to you about. But maybe let's. I think we should probably just back up to how everything got started for you. How did you go from school and start, you know, you got your doctorate, and how did you start getting media attention?
Yeah, so it's like, how did a mild-mannered academic become sort of a TV person? I'll tell you why. Because of all the many kinds of professions out there where people are often scrambling for good information, psychology and mental health is probably the one they most want information, and a lot of people feel like it's a stigma to go for therapy, but they're craving accurate information. And I'll be honest with you, Jason, when I would turn on the TV and I'd see people who were psychological talking heads, I wasn't happy with what I was seeing. So through a series of sort of happenstances here in Los Angeles, I asked around, I talked around, and I'm represented by, ended up getting an agent, you know, and I thought, well, how bizarre as a professor, that's the last thing I ever thought would happen. In fact, I even have my Screen Actors Guild cards at this point because I've done so much television, which is actually really neat. But I ended up getting an agent, and then, you know, like anyone in this town will tell you, you need one break. And I did. I ended up getting on a series on Bravo. And that sort of launched me. And I'll tell you this. If I can keep a classroom of undergraduates awake, television's a piece of cake.
Yeah.
And so there's that piece of it. And then what ended up happening was, because I'm also a clinician in private practice, when you hear enough stories, you start to see themes. And that led to my first and really my second book, where I thought, wow, there's some stuff that a lot of people would say, I want to stop in the session. I want to write down what you're saying. And I thought, well, if you're writing it down, maybe it just needs to be written down.
Yes.
And so that led me to start, you know, writing books I love to write. And now it's kind of, I love doing it. I love being able to take the science of psychology and the knowledge of clinical practice and making it available for the public. And I actually think that my field is actually about a lot of simple truths that we make too complicated. So I just try to cut to the chase and teach people about human nature.
This is such an important topic. You know, I was watching the news tonight, and the human interest story that they put at the end of the news each day was this lady who sent her boss an email saying, I need to take tomorrow off and just focus on my mental health. And he sent her an email back that essentially said, thank you for being honest about that, and you know, definitely take the time off. And I appreciate you being open and removing the stigma from mental health. And she shared it on social media, and it went viral. And it, when something like that goes viral, it tells me that there's a thirst for that out there. And I think for all too long, for some reason, mental health didn't equate to health. And doesn't it feel like that's starting to change?
Ish. And I'll tell you why. And as especially now, as some of the issues around healthcare are changing, just when we started having more access to mental health care, we're about to have less access to mental health care.
Yeah,
and so
right.
It's very convenient to separate the two. I hate to be cynical and political about it, but if we don't put mental and physical health together, then we can say, well, we don't need to pay for the mental health part. And there's still a lot of primary health care doctors who don't talk about it with their clients. And frankly, I trained in a specialized area of psychology called medical health psych, where I work with people who had both medical problems and mental health issues, because I've never met a person who's struggling with a mental health, who's struggling with a medical health problem, who's not also having significant psychiatric issues, even if it's just simply anxiety. But a lot of them have other stuff going on. And so it's really, really naive to think every one of us has gone through some period of our life where it would have been useful to have an objective and trained observer walk us through. It could have been a breakup. It could have been a loss in the family. It could have been financial problems, other stressors, an episode of depression, substance use, a miscarriage. I don't know a single human being who couldn't have benefited. And yet, such a small percentage of Americans who actually get the mental health services they need. So I think we still have a long way to go. We're getting there, but we are in a time when there's going to be significant setbacks.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because you're exactly right. In a time of budget constraints, people will take mental health and say, well, that's not a physical ailment that could cause death.
Yeah.
And they're so wrong about that. You know, as somebody that, I went through a period of about 6 months where I was drinking way too much and I was depressed. So when you listed off those things, I think a lot of times, you know, people are dealing with more than one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And the hopelessness that you feel with depression is so debilitating that you can't even get out of bed. And I don't know how that's any different from a broken rib or a leg break. You're just not getting out of bed either way.
Oh, no. If somebody hears that you have a diagnosis of cancer or somebody's had a heart attack, people bring casseroles and you're a hero. If people hear that you have depression, more often than not, you hear, get over it.
Yeah.
There's a guy named Dr. Robert Sapolsky, very, very famous neuroscientist from Stanford University. And he once very, very eloquently said, major depression or depression may be the single most debilitating physical illness a human being can experience, because these illnesses have ramifications not only for our neurotransmitters but also our neurohormones. There are biological changes in a person who's experiencing mental health. But at the end of the day, we shouldn't have to legitimize mental health by saying, whoa, it's biological. It's real. And anyone who has walked a mile in those shoes or has been close to someone who has will tell you this is very, very real. So it is, for me, it's absolutely heartbreaking to see it. I am happy to hear about that person's experience at work. I hate to say it, for every one story like that, there's 100 stories where people would have been told, really, you want a mental health day? Don't come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember a specific moment where, I confided in one of my friends that I was struggling a bit and he was a good friend, and he still said something to the effect of, well, man, you just need to get out and, you know, listen to some music and, you know, cheer up a little bit. And I actually thought that was really helpful in this way, that it showed me just how much he had no clue what I was going through, because it's a really weird thing. Like, you can tell it, or at least I could tell, that there was something chemically different in me. It felt like that there was a weight, or like I was wearing this wet wool coat over myself, and there was no getting out of it. Even though, certainly I could have done all those things, but it wouldn't have changed anything. What's happening? Or let's just use me as an example. What's happening in my brain at that point that chemically that's causing depression? I know it could be a lot of things, but.
Well, that's the thing. It can be a lot of things. There are different neurotransmitter systems that are implicated in depression. And where things get tricky is that simply just acting on neurotransmitters may or may not be enough. And there's actually some really, really interesting research on the placebo effect in antidepressants. And what we see is that a pretty significant proportion of the variance on why antidepressants work can be attributed to the placebo effect. And even when a medication, regardless of what neurotransmitter system it acts on, they all seem to work, it lends some credence to that. And there's some very good research on the placebo effect. So I do think there's, like I said, the main culprits are things like serotonin, norepinephrine. These are the neurotransmitters that are typically implicated in depression. But we also see some dopaminergic involvement because reward centers are implicated in depression. So it's not simple. Mental illness, by definition, isn't as simple as other kinds of illness processes. There's lots of things going on in the brain. There are lots of causes. Some people have a genetic history. Some people don't. Some people are more vulnerable to depression because they've been through trauma. Some people aren't. Some people are more vulnerable to depression secondary to substance use. Some people aren't. So I think what's so difficult about what I do, it's as much art as it is science. And though we're desperately trying to understand the science, I'm going to be frank with you. I don't think we're going to have cracked this code in my lifetime. I really don't. I don't think I'm going to be out of a job. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, it's funny that you mentioned the placebo effect. The podcast I put out today was with a guy named Eric Vance. He writes for the New York Times and sometimes mm-hmm. Scientific American. And he did a big story in Scientific American about the placebo effect. And we got into the whole thing about how, like, red pills were better than capsules. Yes. And, you know, like... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, big pills are better than smaller pills.
Yeah,
and... brand names do better than generic, yeah.
And he also had this great study where it was, like, a real doctor that was just wearing a plaid shirt and jeans administered treatment. And then a guy that wasn't a doctor in a lab coat, and he's 6'4", and better results with the guy that people trusted based on appearance alone.
Yes, that's right.
And so, but the thing that he talked about with the placebo effect is we know almost nothing about it except for one key thing, and you just hit on it when you started going through all the neurotransmitters and mm-hmm. hormones and everything that are involved, is that it is a larger system acting in conjunction to try to solve problems. And that's the interesting thing, is there's some level of communal intelligence happening there one way or another, taking us up or down for different reasons. And that it seems like that's just so complex that I don't know if we're going to, you know, figure it out in our lifetime.
Probably not. I mean, I definitely think we're getting closer to some genetic understanding, but we're also understanding this thing we call depression highly overlaps with this thing we call anxiety. And it's sort of this sort of amorphous, neurotically uncomfortable space. And remember, we also have to look at what society values. We like happy people. Okay, happy people are fun to be with. We have to ask ourselves, how sad is too sad? When a person can't get out of bed, bathe themselves, feed themselves, take care of themselves, that's dangerous. But if it's just a person who's just sort of dragging a little, as probably one of the foremost, if not the foremost, placebo researcher in the world is a guy named Dr. Irving Kirsch, who spent a lot of his career at the University of Connecticut, where actually he was my undergrad professor and still a friend to this day.
Oh, nice.
And he's now the associate director of Placebo Research Center at Harvard University.
Wow.
And I remember calling him once, and you know, I was going through a hard time. And I said, what do you think, Irv? I'm really down in the dumps. Should I take meds? And he said to me, sweetheart, you're going through a hard time. You're supposed to be sad when someone breaks your heart, you know? And it was so wise, because what he was basically saying is, like, we cannot medicate away the human experience. Sometimes sad works. Sometimes sad is where we need to be. So it's, where is that line? Where do we go to that point where we want to actually, you know, fool around with the neurotransmitters to really address true distress? And trust me, I've worked with enough severely depressed patients to say nobody should ever live unnecessarily in a space of depression. But the judgment call is also how much of it is forcing us to sort of face a problem, solve a problem, and then get through it. I was in therapy at the time. I mean, all shrinks must be in their own therapy, by the way, is my belief. And so that helped.
It's,
and
just like all lawyers need a lawyer, right?
Amen.
All therapists need a therapist.
Right. And many don't. And so it was an interesting, because in my particular case, I was just going through a rough spell and I had other stuff going wrong. And then, as often happens, the ship righted itself. Yeah. You know, I got through, I took care of me. And so I do think that it's a very complex space. But I do think, though, at the end of the day, we still view mental illness as mental weakness rather than part of the human experience that's very complicated, very interconnected, very culturally dependent too. I mean, if somebody said to me, well, there's a person and they don't have a steady paycheck and they don't have a regular place to live and they just lost their car and their kid is really sick and their mom just died. And you know, I'm like, and I'm worried they're depressed. I'd be like, yeah, that doesn't surprise me that they're depressed, you know? And so, and they don't even have someone they can talk to because they probably can't afford it. So these are, depression is as much a reflection of social causes, societal issues, cultural issues, as they are neurotransmitter changes in the brain. And I think we're naive if we think we can isolate it.
Let me ask a very layman and more than likely very stupid question, but I feel like, you know, when I hear about narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, you're starting to get to the extremes, right? But don't we all, are just in our own uniqueness, all land somewhere on a spectrum?
Yes, and it's interesting you bring up the personality disorders because that's actually one of my clinical expertise is an area I've written about. I've written a book on narcissism. I like that you called yourself a sort of, what was it, false narcissist.
Well, you know why I did is because I dated this girl for 4.5 years and I love her to death still to this day. And she had a borderline personality disorder and she was
ouch.
Yeah, it was tough. And, you know, she would go into dark places for multiple days but she was convinced that I had that I was a narcissist, and I take the, you know, the 31 question test or whatever it is, and I actually scored pretty high on it, and so I got worried. But the thing the thing that I had that was like unquestionable is that I have an enormous amount of empathy. I cry watching America's Got Talent, right? Like, and that's the part that, like, I held on to that part of me for dear life to say, I'm not, you know, I might be a narcissist, but it's not to the point of being a disorder.
Well, I mean, and I think that when you're raising up these issues like narcissism and borderline personality and personality in general, yes, it absolutely is a continuum. Our personalities are sort of like our psychological fingerprints, and they are our pattern of behaving, of reacting, of responding. So once you know someone's personality style, you have a pretty good sense of how they're going to respond to a variety of situations, okay? Yep. Yep. So a narcissistic person is going to be selfish and self-serving, and they're going to lack empathy, and they're going to be really entitled. They're going to tend to be a bully. They're going to be very defensive. They're going to project their stuff onto other people. They're going to be envious of others. They're going to be shady. They're going to be dodgy. They're going to be difficult. They're going to be prone to things like road rage and quick to anger, and they can't regulate their mood. That's a narcissist.
That is so not me. So you're making me feel a lot better.
Yeah, that's a narcissist. And so, you know, now are there healthier forms of quote unquote narcissism? I don't even like calling it healthy narcissism. I like calling things healthy self-advocacy. So for example, if somebody said, hey, we've got, would you do all the dishes? You live with a group and somebody says, will you do the dishes every day and none of us are going to help you out? And you say, no, I really only want to do dishes one day because there's six of us. That doesn't make you a narcissist. That makes you advocating for yourself.
Yeah.
Every so often, putting yourself first, but checking in with other people's feelings, that's not narcissistic. That's self-advocacy. So we all need some healthy bit of ego. But when it's out of control, like in a narcissist, that's really unhealthy, particularly for other people. This is where narcissism is very different than any other disorder, because narcissism actually does just fine by the person who's experiencing it. They get all their needs met all the time. They get angry a lot. Sometimes they get frustrated when they can't get their way, but they typically completely take care of their needs first. The people who get devastated by narcissism are the people around them, their husbands, their wives, their boyfriends, their girlfriends, their children, their sisters, their brothers, their friends, their coworkers. These people are all devastated by the narcissist. And we are entering a time in history. Actually, I'm right now starting to suss out my third book. And it's really going to be not just my second book was about narcissism in relationships. I'm now going to talk about this more broadly because we're going down quick with the current epidemic of sort of people behaving narcissistically. With borderline personality, that's a slightly, it's on an island unto itself. There's a lot of shared variants. So borderline personality and narcissistic personality sit very close to each other in the diagnostic manual. And they look very similar, except the borderlines are a bit more primitive and panicky and they're much more sort of out of control with their moods and their emotions. They tend to act out more. They tend to be out of control with their behavior in a different way. It's a different, and by my estimation, I find borderline personality to be a more severe clinical disorder.
Let me ask you about borderline, because the one thing with her, I tried really hard to understand, and the part that I had trouble with is when you first hear borderline personality disorder, people will think, well, it just means you're borderline, and that's not what it means at all. And remember the test for it was like you needed to achieve 5 of 9 different indicators. And that seems so broad to me that I told her that I thought, and a layman term, that there is probably several different disorders in there that have yet to be quantified. And she always thought that was me not understanding. And it was just like me trying to do that stupid male thing that I do, but I want to help fix it. I want to fix it for you. And that's not what she needed.
You can't do it. Most clinicians can't do it. I have to say folks with personality disorders do not do well in close relationships. Yeah. There is it's just too much and it's too consistent. My clinical practice is very much focused on people who got into relationships with people with personality disorders and can't make sense of the chaos. And so I work a lot on that end. And it is because what ends up happening is a lot of times people with personality disorders are very charismatic. They're very engaging. They seem very passionate. They're especially for men. Men get sucked in really easily. She's so sexy and she wants to have sex in the backseat of the car and she's so exciting. And when I hear she was so
sexy too.
That's it. And yes. As soon as I hear a man tell me he's met someone who's really sexy, I almost want to say get out, run,
red flags.
Find a girl who looks like a librarian because you're screwed. And so it is a they're really not made for that now. And that's a tough thing to say, because I think a lot of people will say, well, you have no right to say that. Everyone has a right to a human relationship. Of course they do. However, if a person goes into the territory of attempting to enter an intimate relationship with someone with a personality disorder and they don't understand what they're getting into, the other person in the relationship is chronically going to second guess themselves and think, how can I fix this? My answer is you can't fix this. Either adjust to the new world order or get out, because you cannot.
Yeah, I think you were tiptoeing on something that I actually want to talk about, and that's our president is definitely a narcissist, right?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like if I had a goldfish, the goldfish could diagnose it. I mean, it's almost like a laugh, and this is why I'm always shocked and surprised and dismayed, frankly, when to every member of Congress, all of his advisors and every journalist in America keeps scratching their head saying, I can't understand why he's doing that. I'm like, what can't you understand? He's such a, it's like, I'm like a biologist who's found the perfect specimen of something. Yeah. Like Trump is the perfect specimen. He is so textbook. So in that way, Trump's behavior is as predictable as winter in Chicago. I promise you it's going to be cold.
And the
problem, it's absolutely predictable.
With somebody that predictable is number one, people want to follow him because they feel like he's a strong person. But the dangerous part about him is, at least in my opinion, it seems like people like that are also extremely easy to manipulate.
They're easy to manipulate, but it's all what you've got to do is you've got to get on board with their agenda.
Yes.
And so, with Trump, my God, he'd be so easy to manipulate, so easy. And what I think his inner circle in the White House is doing is trying to be the one who manipulates him best. It's almost like I can almost imagine it's a bunch of people saying, what can we do? You're so smart. You're so great. Yeah, don't worry. Russia, not a worry. The Americans, all the bad media, fake news. I mean, I can't even imagine. It's like the emperor is wearing no clothes kind of a scenario. And it's my problem is this is not about me being political. Obviously, you could probably guess which way my politics lean. It doesn't matter whether you like him or not. What this Trump presidency doing, though, is setting this tone that I think America is getting more mean under this regime. I think there's a meanness that's coming from this, a sense that bullying is okay, that the bottom line is everything, that empathy is for fools. That's the message, that you can lie, cheat, and steal your way out of everything if you are entitled enough. And that message is dangerous for young people to hear. I think it's dangerous for America to hear, because at the end of the day, what that does from my seat as a psychologist is it sucks all of what you need to maintain family ties, community ties, relational ties, parenting ties. Those things all require lots of empathy, lots of compassion, and lots of ability to be present without always being validated. Everyone cannot be prom queen every night of their lives. It's just not how life works.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that as a narcissist in this era, it was very easy to get elected because narcissists are very good at winning the surface level of any debate. Because when it comes to good versus bad, it's like, should people get stuff for free? Of course not. You know that? And then it's like, well, okay, now when we dive deeper into each one of those things, there's so much nuance to this world, but we're not arguing the nuance. We're arguing the face value of things. And it's really easy to point at things.
The more simple the message, the easier it is to uptake. In fact, during the election, Hillary Clinton would always pause a lot more, even in a debate, than Trump.
Yes.
That led people to think Trump was more trustworthy because her hesitation, which may very well have been circumspection, was being viewed as sort of shady, whereas his quick answers were viewed as conviction. That is a psychological trick of the eye. You know, and so in that way, I think that what people believe is, he's saying that, but he doesn't mean it. No, gang, he means it. And so when I work with people who are in relationships with narcissists, they'll say like, well, no, I'm going to be the exception. Like, they're going to come around. They'll get it. I'm like, no, they're not. And I am not kidding you. I've seen people 20 years later come back and say, you're right. They never got it. And I'm like, and you just wasted 20 years of your life. Well done. You know, because everyone thinks they're the one who's going to turn the narcissist around. Trust me, if I can't turn him around, you can't either.
Yeah. You know, I after I quit drinking and I decided that it was a really good idea to go to a therapist, and I really enjoyed it. I went every week for like a year. And one interesting conversation I got into with the therapist is I said, you know, I'm looking at your bookcase, and the DSM manual is up there as DSM-5. And I asked him, like, if there's a 5, that means at least one thing in 4 was wrong.
And, more than one thing.
Right? And
more than one.
So there's almost certainly going to be a 6 and a 7 and a 142. Uh-huh. And I said, doesn't that cause you to question even some of the things that you're doing, knowing that there's something in that book that we haven't learned, and being open-minded? And I'm making a judgment here, but he didn't seem to agree with me in a sense.
I agree with you.
I think he was like, well, this is the best available information, so this is what we're going to go with. And I always felt like
it's not the best.
Things you should. Actually, talk me through that. Like in your treatment of people, when you want to treat someone in a different way than what the DSM is saying, how does that work?
I'm going to be cynical here. I think the DSM is not the best available. I think the DSM is very political. The DSM is written by psychiatrists, okay, who are only a thin sliver of the world of mental health. It's not always based on the best science. And a lot of it, if you look at the people who are made up the DSM, a lot of them sit on the advisory boards of pharmaceutical companies.
Oh.
So if you got a diagnosis, then you need a pill, don't you? Big pharma and psych meds are the biggest slice of the pharmaceutical market in the United States.
Oh, really?
So,
even more than pain pills?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Of course, yeah.
Wow.
Create a diagnosis, and now you need a medication. And the other ones on board with that are the insurers, okay? So when you have all that, I'm really wondering, are these diagnoses necessary? A diagnosis is it's a framework. And a diagnosis should really only have one function: to organize symptoms so we can come up with the best possible treatment. For some disorders, like major depressive disorder, or what we call depression, we know that the best treatment, the best evidence-based treatment, is cognitive behavioral therapy, and in more severe cases, with moderate to severe cases, combined with medication. By far, that has been showed in trial after trial to be the best treatment for depression. In that particular case, this thing we call depression, it hangs together. But there are other diagnoses in the DSM that feel like they're more political than anything. If the needle keeps moving, you wonder how much of this is being driven by political forces and whatnot. Listen, in the DSM-3, they were still diagnosing something called ego dystonic homosexuality. So this thing keeps moving
around. I don't even know
around.
What that is, but I can guess.
It's basically talking about people who are gay, but not entirely down with their gayness, which would be anyone who's from a community where being gay is stigmatized.
Right, yeah,
and so here and here we thought we could diagnose it. So don't tell me this thing is accurate. The way we diagnose personality disorders, a lot of people say it shouldn't be a yes, no, but it should be a continuum, that there's a set of traits that get more and more severe. And the more and more severe they get, the more debilitating they are. I was trained in a way where, to me, a diagnosis is sort of at best it's a throwaway or something I can use to organize stuff. But at the end of the day, I want to know, a person who's sitting across from me, what is causing their distress? And also, on the flip side, and I would love to see a different kind of a DSM. The DSM is all about what's wrong with people. We need a DSM that gets at what's right with people. Mm-hmm. Show me resilience. You know, show me a diagnosis for resilience. Show me a diagnosis for hardiness.
Yeah,
show me a diagnosis
so
for
good.
Outstanding coping. You know, so when I bring a client in, I'm like, you just told me what's wrong with me, with you. Tell me what's right with you. And a lot of people go, well, what are you saying? I said, you can't tell me there's nothing. You had enough wherewithal to come up to the sixth floor today and see me. And it breaks my heart at how well-versed we are at telling people what's wrong with us, but not what's right with us, in a really self-possessed manner. We don't have that diagnostic manual. So no, the DSM is very, very flawed. Each version gets a little better. Each version is more based on research, but each version also faces market forces like pharma and insurers who have way too many sticky fingers in the process.
Gosh, you just blew my mind there, because one thing, I broke my neck and had to relearn to walk. I was paralyzed from the neck down. And I think about that time and the time with the depression. And I really think that resilience was my cure. It wasn't any of the other shit that was going on. It mm-hmm. was just that. And you're so right. Like, if you could diagnose and help help people's level of resilience, or why aren't we studying the placebo effect even more? And like, whatever is working in that person, like, can we get it to work in other people?
Well, answer your own question, Jason. Why do you think there's not more funded research on the placebo effect?
Yeah, because you could just have a really expensive placebo pill. Maybe somebody could bet on that.
I'll tell you why. Because big pharma doesn't want Americans to be doing placebo. But you know where they're doing a lot of good placebo research is Europe. And that's where a lot of the best placebo research happens, and where most of the researchers have clustered, because Big Pharma doesn't run the show there the way it does in the United States. So these are multinational companies. So no, I mean, we absolutely should be doing, because we know the power of the human mind. Listen, until the last century or two, we were counting on the human mind.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's all we had. Yeah. What do you think a shaman did?
Yeah,
you know, a shaman went and used the human mind. And I don't know. I'm simply a shaman with a PhD. Honestly, I sit in a room and I'm really trying to say, like, how can I get into this person's spirit and their mind and be present with them in a way? And I was trained very humanistically, which is, I am not the expert on you. You're the expert on you. Let me walk you through this kind of thing. I believe in you, so let's do it and be present with you. But that's shamanism.
You know,
and that's really about harnessing a person. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, you're killing it right now. But you said something earlier that made me put two and two together, and for some reason I never thought about this, but when I did break my neck, they gave me just bags of Vicodin, right? And mm-hmm. there's one thing I noticed about Vicodin, going to your earlier comment about the big pharma being in the psychology and anti-anxiety and depression side, is Vicodin never truly took away any of the pain. But it did make me feel happy. Like, I was giddy, and I would giggle and whatnot. And so I actually only used it recreationally, right? Because it was more fun to use in that way. And I guess I didn't put two and two together, but Vicodin's not really a pain pill at all. It's a happy pill.
Well, I mean, it acts on receptors in the brain. It acts on the receptors in the brain that do address pain. But remember, pain is a psychological phenomenon. You have a physical experience, and we have this experience called nociception, or an actual sensory interruption. And then that experience through spinal cord and brain gets interpreted. It's why we have seen elite athletes, Olympians, NBA guys, who probably had a little hairline fracture and still played a game out, okay? Yeah. Whereas you or I with that same hairline fracture would be laid up for 3 days. Same fracture. Different psychological experience. It's different meaning. being associated with it. Some people will hurt their back and be out of work for 6 months. Another person will hurt their back and be back in a week. We don't have a good way to quantify it other than a person's subjective experience. Pain is a subjective experience. That's why it's so difficult to treat, because all we got is what somebody tells us. And we know that the experience of pain is made worse by psychiatric and psychological issues like stress, like depression, anxiety, a culture. All these things come together to impact somebody's actual expression of pain. We never can really find out how much pain a person's in. We can't stick a meter in someone and have it ring, show us a figure. We can look at their face, we can see if they're sweating, we can see if their heart's racing, but even still, the same pain stimulus is going to be different for two people. So that's where pain is a very psychological phenomenon. And so when we try to obviously get the person to have more opioids released, that's going to help with that response. But at the end of the day, there are also psychological factors. There's, in fact, the pain literature is very clear. You must include behavioral treatments of all kinds, breathing, meditation, muscle relaxation, therapy, stress management, as enhancements for the use of just pain medication, or you're not doing it right. So, you know, that at the end of the day, a lot of these things are psychological phenomena, but we want the magic pill. We're a magic pill culture. We want everything quick. Our iPhones do things fast. Our cars do things fast. We're able to do things fast. If I came up with a pill that could take away people's broken hearts, I would be richer than that Amazon guy. I'll tell you that right now. So I'm not kidding. Like, I would be, and I cannot tell you how many people like will say to me, "Doc, isn't there a pill you can make to make this go away?" I said, "No." And broken hearts suck, but you know, honestly, some of the best poetry and art came out of broken hearts. It's part of your story. You don't get to get out of this life without one.
Now, MAPS has been doing a lot of research on a 3-dose clinical trial with MDMA that's showing like 90%+ success rate. And there's a lot of pushback on it because it's a quote-unquote drug by Big Pharma. What's your take on things like MDMA or marijuana or some of the things that are in a high schedule right now, because they are both drugs in the traditional sense, but also not patentable?
Right. Well, I mean, I think marijuana is such a is such a controversial issue. I mean, I live in California, where we now have decriminalized marijuana. And, you know, these chickens have yet to come home to roost. You know, the standing argument is marijuana is probably not as dangerous for you as alcohol. That's probably true to some degree. Yeah. But we're kidding ourselves if we say with marijuana, you have a get out of jail free card here. Right. I mean, it's still doing stuff to the human. I mean, it is a psychoactive substance. It is impacting the central nervous system. And day over day use of marijuana, especially in adolescents, and a lot of that good research has come out of different parts of the world, like Australia, longitudinal studies are showing that there are impacts on things like attention, concentration, memory, the very thing the teenager needs to learn in school and learn the skills they need to build a job and a life. And so that said, though, marijuana, you know, especially when we look at CBD, yep. You know, the part of marijuana that doesn't make you high, if you will, there have been some really promising work showing this, suggesting effects on seizures. And yep. So, I mean, I think marijuana has been critical. I work in the area of HIV and how it manages nausea. It's been used in the management of pain and considered far less toxic than narcotic medication. So we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. But here again, the United States are just not doing enough clinical trials, because I think marijuana competes with the drugs Big Pharma is trying to push.
Yeah.
So that's a big problem. And then when we look at drugs like MDMA, I think a tricky bit there is MDMA is sort of like your club drug and your rave drug and all of that. And it's a complicated drug. If I'm trying to remember, what is off the top of my head, I'm not even remembering what MDMA is. It causes that sense of euphoria, and obviously people, it's sort of often you've sort of this.
It is a like methamphetamine, essentially,
yeah,
right?
It's got meth in it, and then it acts on multiple neurotransmitter systems. People will almost, you know, say that they're much more connected with the universe, and you know, and people who are very sort of open to experience, well, new experiences, will want to use MDMA. And you know, one of the, but MDMA also has a lot of physiological effects, especially like overheating and that kind of, and that's often what's caused problems at rates, young people using too much MDMA and getting really sick. I've no doubt. And in fact, there was a time, I think actually in the 70s, they were using it as part of psychotherapy. And you know, to sort of see if, I guess, creating the sense of openness and all of that. But it is a, they are thinking that MDMA could potentially be useful in low doses for the treatment of some psychiatric disorders. Like, I think even PTSD has been raised there as a possibility. We must do, though, well-controlled, blinded clinical trials to study this further. And that's, you know, and that's the challenge, is that we don't always get the chance to do these things. In the United States, it's tough to do these kinds of trials. So, you know, I think that there's a lot we still don't know. And there's a certain politics to drug trials.
Yes.
So, you know, and like, it's the same thing. A lot of people will say the reason marijuana really always got the bad rap and alcohol didn't was it was associated with a certain sort of social class and race. And it
That's
had
right.
all these negative implications that had nothing to do with the actual central nervous system implications of the drugs. As far as I'm concerned, if you're going to legalize or not legalize drugs, you let science drive those decisions, not sociopolitical issues. But that's not how it's
done. Amen. That's awesome. I agree with you 100%. I think, you know, something like marijuana or a plant like kratom is, if it's impossible to overdose on it, it should not get to be Schedule One. You know, I just don't see how you can say it has no possible usage medicinally, you know. And I agree with you, though. The use of marijuana every day is just like any medicine becomes a poison at some point. And as soon as you start using it every day, it's going to start having negative effects.
It is. And again, what happens is if a person says, I can't go to sleep without smoking weed, or I can't cope with X or Y without smoking weed, or I smoke weed as soon as I get home, that's a concern, because it definitely has a numbing kind of softening effect, and it is a way to shut the world out. And we know we're seeing more and more high THC marijuana out there, and that actually in people who are vulnerable to psychosis already can be quite dangerous. So I mean, as marijuana is, as the strains are getting and the strands are getting much more, people are really chemically enhancing them in very specific ways. It's not your dad's marijuana. You know, it's a different game right now. And so as a result, we're not seeing, just now people are beginning to do the research on it. But we, again, these chickens are still haven't come home to roost. And I am seeing more and more, because it's legally available, is that more and more people are becoming, I don't want to use the word dependent on it as much as reliant on it. It's a difference.
And that
becomes a crutch. And as far as I'm concerned, where the human psyche is concerned, crutches are less than optimal.
Yeah. While we were going through all that, I don't want to let it slide. You said you do a lot of work in the HIV field.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I've been doing HIV research even since I was finishing up my undergraduate degree. So that just aged me like for 25 years. And so from a student all the way up to being a professor, I've had an extraordinary view on a pandemic range, you know, that started from people getting an illness and dying within a year or sometimes a month to now what is, if appropriately caught and managed in the United States, is a manageable illness. And yet in different parts of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, it's still a huge problem, particularly, for example, in young women. In the United States, remains a terrible problem in young black men, you know, young black gay men.
Yeah.
And so but you got to remember, nowadays, you know, it's not the 1980s where we were talking about blood supplies and all that. This is a preventable illness. And there are all kinds of new tools we have, like pre-exposure prophylaxis, actually people at risk taking medication every day to prevent getting HIV. We've got some techniques. We know how to prevent this. So when people are still getting it, it's the psychologist's job to help people figure out how can we make these behavioral changes. So I specifically study actually personality disorders in people with HIV, because personality disorders are associated with so much behavioral dysregulation and the risks associated with that. For example, if you already have HIV, do you have safe sex? Or if you don't have it yet, is it putting you at risk for having unsafe sex or unsafe partners? So that's the kind of work I do in that space, and I especially do focus on women. So, and I'm now starting new research with folks in South Africa on it. So,
I think, you know, we were talking a little bit about marijuana, and you know, even the name change of marijuana was to stigmatize it as you know, more of a Mexican drug. And when I think about HIV, it's one of our more shameful time periods, where it was, because it was predominantly the gay community, and then predominantly gay African American and Latino community. It wasn't until it started hitting the white demographic that it really got any attention from the Reagan administration,
and it never did. I mean, by the time Reagan mentioned it, the damage was done.
He didn't even say it until like 87 or something.
87, that's right. 87. But you got to remember, HIV has always been the disease of the other. Gay men, people of color, and even amongst women who got HIV, when the women got it, they were women who were sex workers or they were hemophiliacs. Like, they weren't me, they were someone else. And by making HIV the disease of the other, we delayed the kind of important work. If this disease was getting white men in Ohio and housewives, they would have jumped on this thing so fast. And it was a really sad, tragic, cautionary tale, which we're still not listening to, that when we let those kinds of biased politics lead science, lots of people died unnecessarily and research got delayed unnecessarily. And it was sort of like, you know, a wall against science through hatred, really. And that's a terrible thing to consider, but it is still a scourge in so much of the world. Again, in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, it's still a big, big problem. And we are sort of conveniently forgetting that. So for me, that has been this idea of stigmatizing people because they're different and then not even doing the research you need to do. This was a tragic chapter in America. And already in the new administration, people who do HIV research are stepping away from the White House Office on AIDS because they're like, we can't, under the rules and regulations and policies here, they can't do their jobs. So I think we're going to see some real slidebacks in HIV funding and the kinds of things we need to sort of, you know, not only crack this nut in the United States, but especially abroad, where I think it's important that this is a worldwide effort to understand this epidemic. And there's lots of psychiatric implications in HIV. It's very stressful. It's very stigmatized. There are direct central nervous system effects. And so there's a lot of issues that psychology cares about deeply in the world of HIV.
Do we have the ability to eliminate HIV from the world?
If you can teach us all a way to have people have only safe sex and choose partners safely and stop violence against women. Yep. I think we could get, and stop injection drug use. We got it. That's all it would take.
How does violence against women come into play?
Because when a woman is forced into sex, she has no say. She's not, what's she going to say? Well, before you sexually assault me, could you put a condom on?
I see.
That's not going to happen. And when you have consistent violence against women, even if the woman's not being sexually assaulted, it sets a tone for this idea that the woman feels that she does have no choice. And may succumb to sexual relationships that are not safe, or doesn't feel she even has the right to ask questions about her partners because of an ongoing history of violence. And we do know that a history of sexual trauma or sexual abuse in a woman significantly raises the likelihood of risk for HIV.
Bringing this full circle a little bit, is when you talk about your book, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a relationship with a narcissist, a lot of times let me actually back up and ask, are narcissists mostly male?
I know they are mostly male, because you think about it, it's when you think about privilege, male privilege, that's a setup for narcissism, right? Entitlement and all of that. However, the women are gaining ground, you know, so it's significantly more prevalent in men.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, I'm going to kind of shoehorn this into this part of the conversation, is if you look at a lot of animal cultures, it's the male, especially in birds, that's a colorful, beautiful one, and he's doing his dance and showing off for the very plainly colored female. And in with humans, you know, it's it previously, it's starting to change more, but the women were more beautiful and doing a lot more care for themselves to attract the other
right.
species. I wonder that it's such an interesting dynamic, because while the woman's getting more beautiful, it's still the male doing that proverbial dance where he's hunting and trying
right.
to, and I have never seen that in any other culture. It's usually the colorful one that's also the hunter in a relationship.
Well, you got to remember, sperm are cheap and eggs are expensive, you know. So a woman's womb is a valuable asset. It really is in most species, right? Because, you know, a man could, in theory, father 1,000 children, but he won't be able to feed them all. And there's no point to having a baby unless that baby gets to reproductive age and creates more babies, right?
Right.
So you can't have 1,000 kids. You can't feed 1,000 kids. So you're going to choose judiciously. So you're going to choose the womb that's going to give you the healthiest baby and certain characteristics. And that's sort of applying evolution to human mating. However, humans live a long time. Human gestation takes a long time. Human babies are born relatively helpless. There's a lot of other biological factors at play, and we've evolved that beyond that, you know. And so what has happened is that human mating is also about resource allocation and a woman wanting to get a lot of resources as well. And so she wants to look attractive to her male partner. So again, that's a whole area of study in evolutionary psychology. And that, are there differences? Yes. Hormonally, men and women are different. Men have testosterone. They have different kinds of hormones that will drive behavior somewhat differently. But at the end of the day, Jason, it's really how society socializes us. I mean, too often, boys are given the message of, well, how are you got to get a job and take care of a family. Girls don't get that message as much. They should.
Yeah.
You know, they should, yeah. But they don't. And so I do think a lot of it is like, what is a strong man does this, a weak man does that. And they're very gendered characteristics. And weak and strong are value, are terms with value labels. So I think, sadly, we view traits like empathy and compassion as weak traits because it means you'll lose in battle. The hunter who's empathic may actually let someone else get a shot off on the thing that they're trying to kill. So, you know, you can't, that in the long term, empathy can be an expensive strategy. I'd argue it's not, because I think that it makes the whole tribe healthier. But I think some of the traits men get socialized for can make them more vulnerable to narcissism. But I know a lot of men who are not, most men are not narcissistic. So, I mean, I don't want it to make it sound like, you know, all men have this. But I do think that, yeah, I mean, there is a bit of a hunter piece, and a lot of people say, well, let the guy call the girl and all of that, and that's all good and well, but I do think we've evolved a bit past that, and relationships can be balanced and egalitarian, and it doesn't require a man dragging a woman by her hair with his knuckles dragging on the floor. I think we're a little past that.
Sometimes I wonder, but yeah, I think we're getting there. Let me ask you a kind of a tongue-in-cheek question. Let's skip to the back of the book. What's the answer? Should you stay or should you go?
It's a really big, it depends. In the long term, going is usually the better, you know, the better strategy.
Yeah.
A relationship with a narcissist is a pretty bleak place. I mean, you think about it. If you're in a relationship with someone who's chronically entitled, lacks empathy, is constantly needs validation and is very superficial, that might be fun for about 3 to 6 months, and that's how they often hook people. They put on a great show of it. They take you to the best restaurants, and they drive a fast car, and they take you on these big dates, and they're the ones with the big marriage proposals, like, let's get a balloon and 27,000 other balloons and 52 bottles of champagne and put it all over Facebook. Versus, you know, you're sitting with your girlfriend at Starbucks and you're like, you know what? Like, I like you. Let's put a ring on. Let's get married. You know?
And that's why my ex-girlfriend thought I was a narcissist, because I was that guy.
Yeah, that's probably a healthier approach, because when it has
showman,
to be the big show, the showman is not such a good thing, because
no,
it's usually
what
being
I was.
Done.
Yeah.
Because you often do it to get validation. Why
yes.
else put on a show? And so that doesn't work well in a long-term relationship, because narcissists get bored very easily.
Yes.
And so then the other person in the relationship chronically feels like, well, how do I get all that attention back? And they get stuck in the first 3 months of the relationship. They'll say, but it was so good in the first 3 months. They said, of course it was good. They were putting on a show. Like, you know, a theater is no fun when it's empty, but it sure is fun when there's a show in it.
Yeah.
You know, you're in an empty theater right now. And so to the degree somebody wants a full, you know, full, consistent, loving, respectful relationship, they aren't going to find it with a narcissistic partner. Now, here's the rub. Sometimes people, many times people get into these narcissistic relationships because the person put on a good show and took out the fancy credit card and did all the fancy stuff and all of that. And now they're married, or they've got a kid, or yep. their culture has prohibitions, or the religion has prohibitions, or they're financially dependent. It's never going to be my place to tell someone to leave a relationship. I can tell you what it's going to feel like, and I can say it's not going to feel good. So I train people, because I'll have people say, I'm not leaving. And I'll say, great, I'm glad you told me that. I'm going to teach you how to stay. And it's a pretty sad story, because basically you have to manage your expectations and you got to drop them down to the ground. This is, if the person's never remembered your birthday, they ain't going to start now. If they've cheated on you a lot, they're going to keep cheating. If they lied to you, they're going to keep lying. And if they've never shown you any empathy, please don't expect them to change. So you need to cultivate a better, you have to cultivate friendships. You've got to realize that don't go to an empty well. Okay, throw a bucket in an empty well, you're going to pull in nothing back. And that's what that relationship is. Find neutral topics to talk about. The weather, the neighbor's new mailbox. Never tell them good news. Never tell them bad news. Well, people say, well, that's no longer a relationship. I said, it never was. At least now you're not fighting anymore.
Help me for a second. In all of my relationships, I've always been very respectful and kind and didn't, you know, cheat or beat or any of the bad things. But you did nail me right on the nose when you said that I get bored easily. Here I am at 42 years old, and I've had 7 relationships that have been more than a year. And a couple years ago, I decided I just wasn't going to get in a relationship again because I knew how that party was going to end. But at some point, I'm going to want to share my life with somebody. How do I successfully do that as, I hesitate to say a narcissist, but it sure seems to fit.
Well, I think that number one is that I'm not sure when the memo went out that relationships are supposed to be exciting. Okay. If anything, that relationships are touchstones. They should be healthy places of respect, mutuality, and growth. Roller coasters are exciting. Vegas is exciting. Mm-hmm. Relationship can be. Sometimes your partner will surprise you, but I don't know. When you're 82 years old and you can't use the toilet anymore, I don't know how many more surprises you want, but it sure would be nice to have someone who can help you wipe your ass. And so I do think that that idea of excitement, that to me almost feels like a media construction. Like everything is supposed to be like a big kiss on a snowy night and a
right.
breathless
love
proposal.
At first sight.
The rom-com to me was the destruction of the human relationship. I often tell my clients, will you start going out with boring person? Because a boring person's going to wipe your ass. Yeah. And I know at 40, you're not thinking about ass wiping yet, but it's going to be hard to find that person when you're 75 because all the good ones are going to be gone or dead.
You're exactly right. I guess I didn't really think about it that way. How do you feel about like a very transactional business relationship where two people have a bond specifically for that reason because there's power in numbers?
What do you mean power in numbers?
Well, what I mean is like because I've been thinking a lot about this. Like, if I could find the right person that was exactly what you were talking about, isn't looking for the whirlwind movie love affair, but would like somebody else to go out to dinner with and talk about the day but it's more transactional where it almost becomes as much a business partnership as it is a love affair.
I mean, I hate to think that because that makes it very reductionistic. And that's when it starts to get dangerous, because then when you get into balance sheet romance, how do you quantify things? You know, and so there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times recently where somebody had this, she was writing about how I think every year her and her partner sit down and sort of renegotiate a contract with each other.
Yeah.
And the comments were more interesting than the article, because a lot of the people were down with it. I wasn't loving it, because I think human relationships is the reason a lot of chaos and craziness and emotion and excitement isn't always good in the long term is because life happens. And when life happens, a job gets lost, a family member gets sick, you're going to your own dark night of the soul. Do you really want the person to say, could you get over your stuff? Because I really want to go to the club and I want us to go to Venice and I want to go on a hot air balloon. You're like, slow down, sister. Like, my mom's sick. you know? Yeah. So it's that sense of life happens. And maybe when you're 20, 25, 30 years old, there's not a lot of life happening. But it is, I do think that idea of it being transactional, that if it has to be spelled out, that concerns me. But I think if you talk to anybody who is in a good, healthy relationship, they'll say, you know, when I go to bed at night, the books always feel balanced.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's it. It's not because of the dollars and cents or you put out the trash and I did the wash, but because you filled my soul and I filled your soul and we're good.
And it's really comes back to that, like not letting the highs get too high or the lows get too low, right?
And I think it's also, yes, highs and, but remember, everyone's highs and lows are different. For some people, even after 10, 20, 30 years, their partner walks in the door at the end of the day and they still feel a little bit giddy. That still happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, are you going to feel it the same, that same weak need kind of, you know, gut punch thing as the first 6 to 8 weeks? Probably not. But I do think that it is about, we are getting in the Instagram world of relationships where it's become a pissing contest. I think we've really lost the true connective tissue and the core of a relationship. I don't think it's so much about ups and downs and side to side as much as people really managing their expectation and what's right for me may not be what's right for you. As long as it's what's right for you and your partner. And listen, I've worked with couples where people that they have, you know, they have sex outside of the relationship with other people and they're fine with it. That's not for me, but it is for them. There are people who live 7 months of the year apart. So every people and those relationships are doing just fine. So, and yet I know people who play by every rule and it's kind of a mess. So I think that there's so much expectation out there. And I think the problem is we assume that one size fits all.
Yeah.
It doesn't. But I do think people need to be very honest with themselves. Make sure they're having their relationship, not the one their parents want for them, not the one Instagram wants for them, not the one that advertisers want for them, not what their friends want for them, but what's right for you. And as I say, it's real easy for a girl to say, I found a great guy and he makes lots of money and he has a nice car and he owns his own home and he has a great job. And then you can leave out the part and he really treats me badly and he cheats on me a lot and he doesn't care about me. But golly, it's all this other stuff. Then, well, I met this guy and he sofa surfs and he volunteers at a preschool while he finds another job and he really plays the guitar nicely and he treats me like a goddess and he has never said an unkind word to me. I hate to say it, in America, women would still try to bring home guy number one and not guy number two. And until we can change that paradigm and teach our girls and our boys that they need to look for qualities like kindness, compassion, respect, growth, support, and you know, sense of humor, those kinds of qualities versus sex appeal, size of your wallet, size of other things. All of that, until that goes away, we're gonna have a real problem on our hands.
Yeah.
And people like me are never gonna be out of a job.
That's right. Yeah. So it's good for business, right? Yeah. But the other thing is like, because you're in a relationship, you're two individuals trying to be a couple, you're going to have difficulties. And one thing that I've always felt pretty strongly about is there's a lot of times there's a breakdown in communication because people talk about somebody else not meeting them halfway. And the thing that I've always thought is people have to change their definition of halfway, that it's not based on distance, it's based on effort. Because a lot of times it's very difficult for one person to talk. And if it's easy for the other person to talk, they might have to travel 90% of the way, but that 10% was just as hard for the other person.
Absolutely. Well, again, and like you said, what is your halfway? What is someone's halfway? I've often used this analogy, and I talk about it in my book. I wish everyone had sort of their book of, like you had the book of Jason, and I have the book of Romney, and you know, everyone has their book of, and you could kind of hand it over on the third date. And it would say, like, this is my halfway, and these are the things, and these are my foibles, and you know, I do wake up at 6 a.m. and I like to eat the inside of an Oreo and I'm going to cry if you bring up this. And I had this relationship with my dad, and you put all your stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And the person can read that book and say, yeah, I'm not into this. But who the hell is going to do that? We often hold our vulnerabilities back until it's too late because we don't want to be perceived as weak. So I do think that a lot of people sort of do a bait and switch. They try to be someone they're not to get a partner. But then I'm like, well, now you got to save that person because
yes.
If they meet the real you, they don't even know who that person is because they think they're getting someone else. So they'll say, but then I'll lose ask them, and I'll say, if the real you is going to lose this person, then let them be lost. You didn't have them in the first place. But that's a hard place to get to, because we don't communicate those expectations. And, you know, sometimes it is hard for someone to say, this is what I want. And it may, because it may sound strange, or it may sound concerning. And I've had people sit in front of me and say, listen, I want to tell a man, like, I don't want to work once I'm married, and I want to be supported. I said, you need to know that about yourself. So you can approach people, and that you're going to pull back a different kind of guy with that bait than another, but at least you're getting what you want, or so you think. So, and it's, that's the only reality you've got. But I do think a lot of people deceive themselves and make up false narratives so they can get into and stay in relationships.
Yes. And you started your own podcast recently, where, every episode you tackle a topic like this. I know one was about multiple partners and cheating, is that the idea behind it? Is like these really difficult topics that are definitely not one size fits all, and kind of take it from a broad approach, and then it seems like you whittle it down to a couple of basic tenets, and then anything within that framework is allowed, as long as, you know, both people are into it.
Well, that's it. I say everything's on the menu in a relationship as long as everyone's consenting and everyone's okay with it. Just because your friends aren't doing it doesn't mean it's for you. If your husband wants to wear your underwear in the privacy of your bedroom, you don't need to tell everyone on social media. That's what works for you. That's what works for you. Don't judge it, as long as no one's distressed. And I think that in areas of sex, in areas of relationships, there's so much dark secrecy because people literally judge themselves. And I think the more we can lift that sense of shame and judgment,
I think that's
and for me, that's a big piece of my clinical work and what we hope to achieve in the podcast. And, you know, please, you know, don't bring words like shame and judgment into your bedroom, into your intimate spaces, because this is something you're crafting with someone and it needs to be that safe space. And I think that we, sadly, sex in our culture from a very young age is a very shameful, judged space. And we've turned, either we laugh about sex, or we turn it into something to buy, or like in advertising, or we make fun of it, or we judge it. And rarely do we talk about healthy sexuality. We just don't. And so, and that's a shame, because if we could do that, then we could go a long way to getting good information to people so they can make better judgments and stop viewing sex as a magic bullet or something that could be devastating and painful.
It's such a crazy thing. I've talked about it on the podcast a lot, and your podcast, Sexual Disorientation, perfect name for it, because it is one of the five basic things we do, along with eating, breathing, drinking, sleeping. And but from childhood, you're told, don't talk about it, don't think about it, don't touch yourself, don't touch anybody else, and babies are made with storks flying and drop them off, and like, we lie to children from the very beginning about what it is, and then we don't do a good job of teaching it in school at all. And doesn't it seem like that's where a lot of deviancy is caused from, and just a lack of education?
Well, I mean, I think we teach sex very much from a disease model, how to prevent STDs and STIs and unwanted pregnancies. I mean, that's really what it is. Like, sex is a vector for an unwanted child, or sex is a vector for disease. Yes, those are both possibilities. But it's also, like you said, it's a healthy part of the human experience. And there's a decision-making piece in it. And there's, you know, ways to make choices. And it's not a numbers game. And but it's hard, because even if the school's down with it, if the family's not and the community's not, that makes it hard. And then, since probably about 99.9% of people are, you know, from the age of 16 and over have seen pornography, what people are seeing that is called sex is so contorted and twisted, and, you know, not representative. I mean, I think how many men walk around thinking that their penis isn't big enough, and how many women walk around saying, I don't know how to have sex in that position, and everyone walking around feeling inadequate. That's not sex.
Yeah.
That's entertainment. You know, no more than I would watch, you know, that I would watch a superhero film and think I could jump off my balcony in a cape. But I think a lot of people generalize pornography to their real lives. So that's not going to work. And there's a lot of, as a result, there's many couples out there who report some level of sexual satisfaction, where men are saying, well, why can't you do that? And the poor woman's like, do what? Like, I don't even think that's physiologically possible.
Yeah. I feel like sex, just like, you know, your first book, You Are Why You Eat, a lot of times it becomes this crutch where it becomes mm-hmm. a poison itself. And we use sex or food as some sort of weird, very short-term validation toward, you know, to cope with a much bigger long-term problem.
Well, I mean, we use it for a wrong purpose, right? I mean, it's this idea that it could be used as a drug, it could be used as validation. It gets misused, if you will, because it really can be at the ultimate, you know, human shared experience between two people who are in a loving space together. It really can be, and so, but that tends not to be what we talk about as much. So, I think that though that to me is often sort of the commodification and the commercialization of America, because sex sells. And whether it's a sexy woman eating a hamburger, or a hot guy on a billboard, or you know, people having sex in a, you know, for that has nothing to do with the storyline, but getting it so people watch the show, it's used as an advertising device. Once you do that, you cheapen the whole enterprise.
It's so funny you said a woman eating a hamburger. The last person I talked to said a woman eating a hamburger, and it's from this Hardee's commercial where this woman is very sexually eating this hamburger, and for some reason that resonated with people a lot, that commercial, where it was just like they went all in on that. They took it to the like absurd extreme. Mm-hmm. But somehow people just, they saw that and they're like, yep, that's the problem right mm-hmm. there.
Well, I mean, again, you're combining in a country where obesity is an epidemic, a woman who likely doesn't eat that many burgers, who's, you know, abnormally slender,
right,
in sexual dress, eating this food, hamburger, in a certain way, targeted at men. I mean, they were just ticking off all the boxes, weren't they? So and again, I can look at that with a cynical eye. You can look at that with a cynical eye, but maybe not a 13-year-old girl or a 14-year-old boy. And those are the minds I'm more concerned about. You know, if you're a 40-year-old person and you're falling for that ad, then, you know, you need to get out more. But a 13-year-old kid's head is in a very different space, or a 9-year-old kid.
When you talk about 9 and 13, you know, one thing I that you talk about that really resonated with me is how being very poor growing up affected my outlook on the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my dad died when I was 5. So my mom, she was a waitress. We had the book of food stamps, old school style, and didn't have a car, and, you know, had to move around. And it made me have this like disdain for money. And as an adult, like, I still have that disdain. Like, whatever I make, no matter how much I've made, I still live somewhat check to check, because I don't give a shit about that money. I just spend it and pretty frivolously, because I don't want anything to do with it. And you talk a lot about, and you talk about it from a different perspective, what the effect of being poor is on, like, your own self-worth, and mm-hmm. how big of a struggle that is when it's really doesn't have anything to do with your genetic makeup.
That's a very complicated question, because we know that those effects of early scarcity, if you will, they can affect people a lot of ways, but some of it also depends on context, Jason. There's a phenomenal book, a couple of phenomenal books, but one of them, it's her theoretical work more than it's a book, but there's work on this idea of perceived social status, this idea that how do I feel relative to the people around me? Okay. Mm-hmm. So if everyone around me was struggling the same way, then it's not so much of the haves and have nots. It's like, we're all kind of struggling a little bit. And it's, you know, you might even feel like even though everyone was on food stamps, you're firmly in the middle. But if you were on food stamps or other kinds of public assistance and other kids around you were quite affluent, that's going to take a harder toll on someone. That's what some of the literature suggests, is one thing. Also, it's a lot of the narrative around a person? Is there a narrative of hope? Like, this is temporary, we're going to get through this, or this is never going to get better. So how much of it, is there a sense of encouraging some kind of upward mobility, that the teachers are still encouraging the students to excel at school, that they can go on to, you know, higher education or decent jobs, or are kids getting the message like, you're stuck, you're doomed, there is no opportunity, as well as other comorbid characteristics in the environment, mental illness, violence, substance use, other traumas. We look at all of that holistically when we look at these impacts. But and obviously then there's the practical impacts. If a family's on public assistance, are they getting adequate nutrition? Do they have adequate medical care? Is there adequate heating and cooling in the home? Are there other environmental exposures? So you're asking, like I said, a simple question is so complicated because there's so many influences around it.
Yeah.
So when we think about all those impacts, all of those can add up to one person viewing it as a call to arms. Like, I'm going to push back on this. And I actually work with a really phenomenal committee of people at the American Psychological Association where we tackle these issues. And, you know, in doing that work, I myself have met psychologists who have come, who went all the way through their PhD, but came from really, really financially difficult beginnings. And they say, you know, it took one teacher along the way to encourage me. And yet, but they said, and I was actually fine until I finally got to university or graduate school and said, whoa, I got a lot less than everybody else. And so the wake-up call came later. So I think that though it shapes a person's narratives about how scarce things are, how they may actually view money as a tool, how they may hoard money, how they spend it, all of those things are going to be shaped by those early experiences with money and, in essence, not having enough money, not having enough food.
When you were the co-host of My Shopping Addiction on Oxygen, and I'm wondering, like, in your experience with that show specifically, what did you see as some of the main root causes of shopping addiction?
You know, I think that the main root causes are the same reasons people use drugs and alcohol. It's a sense of emptiness, unhappiness, and not being fulfilled. And the funny thing about shopping is, unlike drugs and alcohol, where when you're using, you may get high, but people are sort of judging you. You go shopping and you spend a bunch of money and you go out the next day in your new dress. Not only you get the high from buying the new dress, then you get the high the next day from everyone telling you how fabulous you look.
So it's more dangerous in some ways.
Because people were, I mean, these folks were going into debt, some of them to the tune of $90,000 to $100,000, which can really, in a young person, throw them off course for much of their lives. And so I think that, you know, it was a sad statement on sort of what has become such a consumerist, materialist society, that if only I have that bag, everything's going to be okay. If only I have that car, everything's going to be okay. I'm like, and why? Why would things be okay? Because people would view me differently rather than I would, you know, I could do something to grow internally. And so it is that sense of, it's sort of a cleaner addiction, but it's still an addiction. And it does a lot of damage, not only to the individual, but to their families, to the people around them, to their relationships. Yeah.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show here. And there's one thing that I thought was a really great way to look at the work that you do, and I just wanted to highlight it, is that you talk about psychology almost like personal training. And when we started the show, we talked about like how mental health is health. And so do people have the ability to work out their brain like they do their body?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think people should. Maybe that's what I'll do. I'll open up a mental health gym.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of ways that can be done. Actually, part of it is done in the gym. Exercise and motion are very good for us, but I would argue not gym exercise as much as taking a walk outside where there's no ceiling above you. Things like practicing mindfulness and gratitude, meditation, you know, spending time with other human beings live rather than online and social media, taking time to actually sit at a table and have a good meal. These kinds of things definitely sort of up our mental health quotient. On top of that, it's other things that sort of enhance our cognition, like reading or doing puzzles, solving puzzles, working collaboratively, being part of a community, whether that's a spiritual community or a community group, or like, in other words, you're working with folks on a common cause, you know, that you all want to go out there and fight for something. And so all of those things enhance our mental health in numerous ways. But yet we don't look at a person and say, you know, we might look at a person and say, wow, nice body. We rarely look at a person and say, wow, nice psyche. I would love to think that one day that change could happen.
I love that. So the way that we wrap up every show is I like to give the guest an opportunity to share a phrase, motto, mantra, saying, something that's important to you in your everyday life that that you could maybe help the people out there listening. Do you have something like that for us?
You know, I do. I'm actually going to grab a book because I want to make sure I get it just right, because it's actually a quote I put in the front cover pages of my first book, and I thought it to be quite quite a profound line. So I'll share that one. Let's see.
And this is my own book. You Are Why
my
You Eat.
My first book, You Are Why You Eat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You think I know my own damn book, right? But it's a quote by Lao Tzu, you know, ancient Chinese, you know, philosopher who writes, "At the center of your being, you have the answer. You know who you are, and you know what you want." I think for many of us, and especially in certain matters, our instincts are actually pretty good. If we can silence the voice of others. And going on with more Lao Tzu is, you know, he goes on to say, care about what others think and you will forever be their prisoner. Takes that one step further.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, you've got to own your stuff, because you get one chance at this. And do you really want to be sitting there at the age of, if you're lucky, 85, 90, and say, whoa, I did everything everyone ever asked of me and didn't do any of the things I wanted? I think that while you've got the air in your lungs and the health to do it, live your life fully, because you don't know when this entire thing can be taken away from you for any number of reasons. And if you're lucky, you live a long life. But if you can say, I lived in accordance to what gave me meaning, to what gave me purpose, to what filled my soul, at least at the end of your life, and as you live your life, you will have a true north. Your true north is never going to come from a corporation, from a handbag, from drugs or alcohol or food. It's going to come from within. And as long as you can get to there, I really think that you can listen to yourself. I think people really could get themselves on a really, really good course. Trust that about themselves. I think so many people don't value themselves. Spend some time, instead of figuring out what's wrong with you, focus instead on what's right.
Oh, that's so good. I'm gonna cut that 60 seconds out and promote the show with that. That was so well said. Let's tell people how they can find you. Is there any social media links that you'd like to send people to?
I have I'm terrible at social media, but I do have Twitter, and it's at Dr. Ramani, DocTorRamani. We will be having a Facebook fan page that will be set up soon by an intern working with me, and that will be also Dr. Ramani. But my book, Should I Stay or Should I Go, is going to be coming out in paperback soon.
Nice.
And I think these days, in the new America we live in, this is required reading for everyone. I don't care if you're in a narcissistic relationship, you know someone who is, or even if you have a narcissistic parent, child, coworker, or head of the free world. It's actually a great book to help you sort of decode these relationships and figure out how to get your head around them, because they can be very destabilizing. And my book is really actually one of the easiest to read sort of how-to manuals on how to dismantle a narcissist before they dismantle you.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been
fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Dr. Ramani Dervasula, and I will have all the links in the show notes. Until next time, we are out of here.